seated. Court is ready to hear argument from Relator and Ex Parte Hall.
May it please the Court, Ms. Cynthia Hollingsworth will present arguments for Relator. Ms. Hollingsworth is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the Court, we're here today on an application for writ of habeas corpus from a contempt order that was entered after the court found that Mr. Hall had violated a temporary order of support for payment purportedly for a minor child and his wife. It's important to note that we are here because the court found that Mr. Hall did not pay according to the court order. The court has specifically stated that while there were payments made, those payments could not be credited according to the decisions in McLemore and Holloway. Therefore, we're dealing with the temporary order, which is, we'll see, is not enforceable by contempt because it's based on a contract. That, again, is specifically stated by the court as the basis for its ruling. The temporary was the order...
Ms. Hollingsworth, before you proceed with your legal argument, can you just briefly express the status of the bankruptcy and how this impacted the case?
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm not clear on that.
Okay. Mr. Hall took personal bankruptcy right about the time the court had noticed or given us notice of our submission setting. Since that time, the bankruptcy court, at our request, has lifted the stay so that we could go forward on this issue in the Texas Supreme Court. And the stay is lifted to include this court's ability to decide the case and issue an opinion. The temporary orders are not enforceable by contempt because they are based on a prenuptial agreement. Therefore, it is a debt based on a contract, not based on the statutory guidelines of the Family Code. The reason child support and spousal support can be enforced by contempt is because there are statutory guidelines which provide for their enforcement. Therefore, it is not imprisonment for a debt. Because this order was signed and entered specifically based on a prenuptial agreement and the court's interpretation of that agreement and the court supplying a figure of support which is not included in that agreement, this temporary order has resulted in Mr. Hall being imprisoned for a debt.
Court ordered child support absent the statute is not enforceable by contempt?
That's right. Because it's not child support, it's an enforcement of a contract. There are ways that the court can incorporate an agreement into an order which would make it enforceable by contempt, but that was not done here. One of the most important things is that a hearing was not held in this case, and a hearing is required not only for it to be enforceable by contempt, but when the legislature provided that temporary orders are not appealable, it was because it was contemplated that there would be a hearing. Because as you all know, temporary orders are entered and the matter drags on for 5 years and there's no right to appeal from those temporary orders.
The order in this case does not specify that it was based on the agreement of the parties.
The court says in numerous places in the record that it is based on the prenuptial agreement and the enforcement. On the face of the order, it does not say that.
The respondent characterizes that as sidebar.
Excuse me?
That is characterized in your opposing counsel's brief as sidebar or comments by the judge. Why should we raise to the level of some official comment on the order, judge's remarks about why he might be doing something or other or going to do something or other?
Because this is a contempt hearing, this is not an appeal, and the Rogers case, which is a Corpus Christi case, which deals with whether you can sever orders, and some other cases by this court, whose names I can't recall right now, point out that if you look at the record and the court does not have jurisdiction, then in a contempt matter, you don't presume jurisdiction. And the court here, at the time the court entered the temporary order, at a subsequent May hearing, and at the contempt hearing specifically stated that this was based on a contract which Mr. Hall had sought to enforce, and that the amount had been derived from an exhibit, and that therefore there was no need to have a hearing, that there was no need to determine what was reasonable and necessary because he was basing it on a contract. It's important before it can be enforced by contempt.
If you had a temporary injunction hearing in just a civil case, and the trial judge announced at the conclusion of the hearing, during which he had not allowed the party he was getting ready to rule against to cross-examine witnesses or to complete the presentation of evidence, and the trial judge announced at the end of it that he was going to issue an injunction based upon some excluded evidence, and maybe that was wrong, but that's what he was going to do. And he issues an injunction that's regular on its face, which the party violates. Is that something that can be attacked in habeas corpus collaterally, the fact that the temporary injunction was erroneous and should not have been entered?
Well, I think there's two ways that's different. One is a contempt of incarceration, and I'm assuming that this person was in contempt of that injunction and then was incarcerated. The other reason, the other difference here is he's being incarcerated for a debt based on a contract, not based on a court order. Here the court stated he didn't have to have a hearing. He didn't have a hearing. Now, that's catching me a little off guard, but I do think that if the relator in that case, who was never allowed to cross-examine witnesses, never allowed to put on testimony, subsequently violated what he thought the order meant, I would think his due process had been denied also.
So he could collaterally attack the temporary injunction through habeas.
I think he could if he was denied a right to put on evidence.
What if the judge just shouldn't have abused his discretion in issuing a temporary injunction? He really didn't do something as bad as you complain the trial judge did in this case, not allowing the full presentation of evidence.
But maybe entered a different dollar figure.
But he just made a mistake. He just erred, abused his discretion. Then could that be challenged by habeas?
Well, without giving a specific example, I don't know if I can answer your question, but if you're saying he maybe entered the wrong dollar amount, but that he could have acted, but the figure he entered was wrong, or maybe in some ways it was wrong?
Well, in this case, the trial judge said, well, I'm not going to base this on contract. But just
no,
look,
the trial judge says I am going to base it on contract.
But if in this case he said he was not, he said, I'm not going to base this on the contract, but I just think a fair figure. I don't know. I don't pay attention to these guidelines. I just think a fair figure. What? $5,000 a month. That's what I'm going to order.
Well,
and
I think...
You complained legitimately that was an abuse of discretion to just pull a number out of the air.
I think if the judge did what he did here, and that is he promised that the hearing, that the witness was going to get back on the stand, he said, you're going to have your opportunity to cross-examine. You're going to have your opportunity put on evidence. And then we come to a hearing and the judge says, Mr. Hall, you want that prenuptial agreement enforced? Okay, I'm going to enforce it. It's valid. And under that prenuptial agreement, you have promised to pay Mrs. Hall her living expenses. And this contract doesn't say reasonable and necessary. And you've almost also promised to support her children from another marriage. And we've got an exhibit back in December that has a dollar figure. And no, I'm not going to give you a hearing. And no, it doesn't have to be reasonable and necessary under the family code because I'm not doing it under the family code. And I'm going to enter this order. And the temporary order was entered without a hearing, even though it's an unappealable temporary order. And now they have sought to enforce it by contempt. And the act of attempting to enforce it by contempt makes it worse, especially in light of the fact that the undisputed facts and the records show that Mr. Hall paid more than that. What happened was he didn't pay it to Mrs. Hall at Vassar Drive in University Park. He paid over $200,000, of which they're claiming he should have paid $141,000. He didn't pay all of it to Mrs. Hall. This exhibit that was used by the trial court is an exhibit that was introduced at a December hearing that was on the issue of confidentiality and then went on to temporary orders. And a bookkeeper for Mr. Hall got on the stand and an exhibit was introduced showing an itemized account of the payments that Mrs. Hall had paid during a period of time for Mrs. Hall and how her exorbitant spending could not be supported with her living in the house at Vassar. It was introduced for that purpose. Months later, when Judge O'Donnell said, you want to enforce this? I'm going to enforce it. And Mrs. Hall testified what her expenses were. That's a mistake. She never testified to what her reasonable and necessary or any expenses were. She attempted to. She had not produced the backup documents as required, so the court recessed it. At the contempt hearing, Mr. Hall presented and introduced, approved of the exhibit, which is I-10 in the reply brief, taking that same line item budget that was the basis of the $23,982.75 award of child support and showed that he paid those things to those creditors, the mortgage payment, the utility payment, that he made those payments, and he made some cash payments to Mrs. Hall. Judge O'Donnell said, well, I'm sorry, you've made payments, but under McLemore and Holloway, you didn't make them to her. And so I'm going to hold you in contempt, and I'm going to put you in jail until you pay $141,000 to Marianna Hall and $80,000 to Paul Fanning, $88,000, and $70,000 to Hayden Cooper till you purge yourself of contempt. Well, that's not purging him of contempt. That's paying twice. The court, in essence, is getting his civil and criminal contempt mixed up after it dismissed the criminal contempt and is punishing him for not paying to her, not for not paying. He acknowledged the payment. He acknowledged it on the record, but in the order, he didn't give him credit for that payment, and he didn't give him credit specifically for some checks that we've itemized that are specifically admitted in addition to the overall summary. But the important thing about the temporary order here, in addition to not being based on the statutory guidelines, the court didn't even purport to comply with Section 14 of the Family Code. The court stated several times it didn't have to. It wasn't a family code order that can be enforced by contempt. There's no finding of the necessity of the child. There's no evidence of what the child's necessities are. There's no evidence of what Craig Hall is willing and able to pay. There's no reference to the best interest of the child. The court says he didn't have the hearing because the agreement that Mr. Hall signed, the first marital agreement, which was the premarital agreement, didn't even contemplate the child, the subsequent child of the marriage. It addressed two children, which Mrs. Hall already had, who Mr. Hall subsequently adopted and has provided for. Reasonable and necessary modifies the payments he's got to make for their benefit, but there's no reasonable and necessary for Mrs. Hall. When Judge O'Donnell was asked, well, what if there had been an exhibit saying that she thought she needed $3 million a month to live on based on that agreement, he said he would be eternally grateful that that had not happened because he felt like whatever Mrs. Hall wanted, based on what Mr. Hall had agreed, that he had to pay. Well, I just think if you read the record and the chronology of events, and what we're dealing here with here is jurisdiction, and there's no jurisdiction to enforce this by contempt because it's not under the Family Code, that all the proceedings, the relevant proceedings before this court, and in each instance there was a denial of due process. Mr. Hall was never allowed the opportunity to even cross-examine, much less put on his ability to pay. There is no evidence to support the figure of $23,982.75 except for that line item budget, which is attached to our brief, which undisputedly, according to the court, at the May hearing and at the February hearing and at contempt hearing, and according to Marianna Hall at the contempt hearing, includes support for adult children. Because the $23,982.75 undisputedly includes support for adult children, then the entire commitment order is void and the temporary support order is void.
Is habeas corpus the only way to attack this order, which you say was rendered without due process being accorded to Mr. Hall?
Well, Mr. Hall...
No, there's no right of appeal.
There is no right of...
By mandamus? In other words, could this order remain, temporary order remain in effect for a matter of, well, until the divorce was finally adjudicated and then finally a alleged violation occurred and contemnor be incarcerated without the contemnor ever attempting to attack the temporary order directly by mandamus?
Well, I think what happened here is at the same time the court was hearing the motion for contempt, and I am going to answer your question. At the same time the court was hearing a motion for contempt, it was hearing a motion to reconsider. That's another confusing thing about this record. There's usually two motions being heard at any given time, so who's the moving and who's on third is sometimes hard to figure out. So he thought the court was going to reconsider the order because the court acknowledged there was a problem with at least $675 of it, which related to adult children. So he really wasn't at the point where the court had denied his motion to reconsider where he could ask for a writ of mandamus. I'm afraid if he did ask for a writ of mandamus, that even if the court found that that was an abuse of discretion, that the court could conclude it's just a dollar amount and there's an adequate remedy by appeal on that at the ultimate disposition of the case.
But certainly can't appeal a temporary order.
Right. No, I would. Be, it would be at the end of the divorce case, and the.
How? I mean, that would be, I suppose, merged or at least superseded by the final order, so there wouldn't be the.
And unless there was a finding in the final judgment to preserve that amount, I think I know what you're getting at. Is why didn't he file a writ of mandamus instead of being held in contempt? And I think he had to in this circumstance because the court, the record clearly demonstrates, was hearing the motion to consider at the same time it was hearing the contempt order. And so he didn't have that opportunity. And I'm afraid that the Dallas Court of Appeals, based on previous decisions, would say you don't have a right to a writ of mandamus. Your only remedy is to violate the court order, be held in contempt, and take it up on a writ of habeas corpus. I could cite you a case on that, but I can't off the top of my head.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
The
court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Paul Fanning will present argument from respondent.
May it please the court. I'd like to make one thing clear right off the bat. If we are not talking about an agreed temporary support order, then we lose. We are talking about an agreed temporary support order. I have to concede that I did not know that at the time I took over Mrs. Hall's representation on August 1, 1991, with less than 1 month before these hearings commenced.
What evidence is there of agreement other than two lawyer signatures at the bottom?
Be glad to answer that question. There are eight perfectly good and inescapable reasons why it is a certainty that this is an agreed order. Evidentiary hearings on the issue of temporary support were held on December 26, 27, and 28, 1990. There were no subsequent hearings in which evidence was either offered or accepted after December 28, 1990. Yet the order that was submitted over the signature of both counsel recites, quote, all necessary prerequisites of the law have been legally satisfied, close quote. This is not merely approval as to form. Secondly, the order contains three separate and distinct matters that are completely absent from the evidentiary record and thus solely referable to an agreement by prior counsel. First, the recitation that I previously addressed that all prerequisites of law have been legally satisfied combined with the signatures of both lawyers. Secondly, there is a recitation and the imposition of support retroactively. 2 of the 3 months of which had not even yet occurred when the trial court heard its last evidence. That support order finds arrearages or agrees, stipulates to arrearages for December 1, 1990, which is the 1 month that took place, the one payment which took place, or payment due date which took place prior to the hearing. January 1, 1991, totally subsequent to any evidentiary hearing. February 1, 1991, totally subsequent to any evidentiary hearing. Two of those 3 months had not even yet occurred when the trial court heard its last evidence. Thirdly, there were findings of arrearages and deficiencies for those 3 months in absolute sums certain, right down to the penny they were stipulated to. Trial court never ruled on that. Thirdly, well, I think these three, those aspects are dramatic evidence that it was. Thirdly, on February 26, 1991, Craig Hall himself, during his argument for a continuance, represented to the trial court that he was hiring new counsel to, quote, negotiate, close quote, in a, quote, serious effort to resolve all of the temporary matters, close quote, before the court. Although the trial court on February 26, 1991, instructed that an order on temporary support be presented at a hearing that was scheduled for the immediately following day, February 27, 1991, none was presented. What did happen instead was that on March 7, 1991, the subject order for temporary support was presented to the trial court, signed by the attorneys for both parties. Their signatures on the last page of this order, considering its content and recitations, proves on its face that this order of March 7, 1991 was signed, rendered, and entered by agreement, regardless of what Judge O'Donnell or subsequent counsel for Marianna Hall, without a statement of facts at that time and without having participated in the December 26, 27, 28 hearings, later thought, or said happened. I admit, I'm quoted, I thought that it was a result of a judicial determination, and in their supplemental brief, relator quotes me as saying, exactly. I was wrong. I didn't have the benefit of the record. Now I do. Fourth, don't you think that if Hugh Hackney and Fulbright and Jaworski would have acted without authority, that Hugh Hackney would have been the first witness called? The burden of proof at that time was on the relator to show that this order was entered without his authority. He didn't call Hackney because Hackney's evidence would have been harmful. Relator has not pointed out in his brief because it is relator's Achilles heel. Instead, relator makes reference to Hackney's unsworn, non-testimonial statements. If the order had not been entered by agreement, and if the order had not been signed by the trial court by consent, why would Mr. Hackney feel compelled to make the statement that he sought to, quote, disaffirm it, close quote? Why did Hackney speak in terms of, quote, lack of authority, close quote? Had the order not been entered by consent, Hackney's authority to approve it would have been irrelevant and immaterial. Fifth, if the order had not been entered by consent, Craig Hall would not have continued to contest Hackney's, quote, authority, close quote, during the contempt hearing, but he did. Sixth, Mrs. Hall's attorney, Mr. Gary at the time, expressly pointed out to the trial judge in February, before this order was submitted, that the figures on the exhibit that was provided by Mr. Hall's bookkeeper, not Mrs. Hall's bookkeeper, included amounts for adult children. Thereafter, the parties through their counsel could choose to agree on any support figure they want and without contemplating a penny for adult children. Believe me, guidelines have nothing to do with this case. If the guidelines had been followed and we would have done child support guidelines at 20%, the monthly support payment based upon the income tax return that is before you would have been $160,000 a month. If there had been no agreement, why would Mrs. Hall's attorney, 10 days later, after making the statement to the trial judge, sign an order that he knew the trial judge had no authority to enforce? Seventh, the trial judge specifically ruled on Volume 6, Statement of Facts, 5 and 10, quote, the court rejects your attempted disaffirmation disaffirmance of Hackney to sign his approval to the order. 8, one of the counts. They say that these checks that were issued were somehow solely referable to other things, and the check that they use is in the sum of, it's dated March 8, 1991, it's the date after the order was signed, and the check is in the amount of $28,310, the aggregate of the three or four arrearages found in the temporary support order, less $3,000 that Mr. Hall decided unilaterally to deduct for himself. This check in the sum of $28,310, signed by Craig Hall and dated March 8, 1991, is pretty strong evidence that Hugh Hackney was authorized to agree to and approve the March 7, 1991 temporary support order. Now, the comments made by the judge are really, I think, of no moment. Judge O'Donnell was not privy to the negotiations and discussions between Gary and Hackney. Neither was the Supreme Court of Texas. Additionally, it makes no difference if the trial court knew about those negotiations. It's not up to the trial judge or the Supreme Court to know everything.
But to follow along your own reason, why would the trial judge say he was rendering it on a contract if what was actually happening by, as evidenced by the signatures on the order, an agreement?
The trial judge said that he was rendering it on the contract before the order was signed. Okay? The trial judge was about to make an incorrect order. He didn't, though, because negotiations intervened and agreement intervened. And I've given you 8 reasons that you can know with certainty that is true.
There is another logical explanation.
All right?
The trial judge was in error when he made that statement and continued to be in error, and the attorney acted improperly.
And the attorney what?
Acted improperly.
There is a possible, that's another explanation. Then it would have been Mr. Hall's, the relator's burden to call that attorney and to prove that the attorney acted improperly. He didn't call that attorney. He didn't carry that burden of proof. It wasn't the mother's burden of proof here. It was their burden of proof. The record is devoid of them calling Mr. Hackney on that evidentiary point. I think of a more important issue and one that really does deserve the attention of this court is the issue of appellate attorney's fees. That, it seems to me, although there's rhetoric in the relator's brief concerning the chilling effect that he would have if he has to pay attorney's fees in the appellate court level and does not prevail, I think the chilling obviously has not had a chilling effect on the relator. The relator has filed an application for writ of habeas corpus in the trial court. The relator filed an application for writ of habeas corpus in the Court of Appeals, a second application for writ of habeas corpus in the Court of Appeals, a third application for writ of habeas corpus in the Court of Appeals. He amended that application, the third application in the Court of Appeals, and he tried to amend it again. He's filed an application for writ of habeas corpus before you. He's amended that application for writ of habeas corpus, and he's filed a supplemental application for writ of habeas corpus before you. Obviously, the appellate court attorney's fees has not had a chilling effect on the relator. But I think this court needs to direct its attention to the chilling effect that a lack of granting appellate court attorney's fees has on kids. Justice Cook inquired,
well, what type of lifestyle these kids have that requires $24,000 a month child support?
Well, obviously inadequate, sir, because if I see Mr. Hall's exhibit, if I read Mr. Hall's exhibit correctly, he says that he's paid $43,000 a month. So obviously the $24,000 a month would be inadequate. We don't even suspect Mr. Hall would pay less than what was due.
I understand Ms. Hall to say that he overpaid.
Mr. Hall wants this court to buy his argument that his payment for a condominium in Miami Beach on the top floor of a big high-rise there should be credited toward his child support payments. Mr. Hall wants this court to credit him with the payment by his wife in August of 1991 since he hadn't given her any support and was trying to starve her out, there were 10 or 15 Krugerrands, I believe she testified, 5 or 10 or 10 or 15, one or the other, that she had in the house and she cashed in to buy groceries. Mr. Hall made a lot of payments directly to his creditors that he wants this court to, and he wanted the trial court and he wanted the Court of Appeals to credit toward his support payments. The court didn't order him to pay his creditors. The court ordered him to pay his wife and he didn't want to do it.
But he agreed to pay his support.
Oh, he did. He did agree. That does not affect Mr. Hall's subsequent conduct in this or in other situations. The statutory grants for the award of attorney's fees, I think, are 3.58 C2 and 4, 3.59, 11, 11, 11A2 and 5, 1118 and 1119. As in civil cases, 1119 talks about as in civil cases generally, i.e. equal protection, chilling effect. In Section 1433 empowers the trial court to award attorney's fees in any enforcement action, and C actually makes the award of attorney's fees mandatory in child support collection cases. None of the statutory grants of authority for the imposition of attorney's fees are limited to the trial court attorney's fees. The statutory purpose is precisely what is directed and what is the subject of this case. The statutory purpose is precisely to enable a financially disadvantaged party to a divorce or a suit affecting the parent-child relationship to effectively conduct litigation against a financially stronger opponent.
Castle, what are the age of the children?
Christine is 11. There's only one child, Your Honor.
But he adopted two others.
They're adults. They're not children in interest in this suit, nor is there support for those children in interest in this suit. You will not find any reference to adult children, any reference to premarital agreement in that support order. It's not.
You say he agreed to pay $24,000 a month for one child support.
No, sir. He agreed to pay $24,000 a month as temporary support to his wife, as his temporary alimony and temporary child support combined. And the guidelines for imposition of post-divorce child support, I really don't believe have any application to the pre-divorce where the court is trying to maintain status quo and establish peace so it can get out with litigation and the parties can survive the litigation process.
Counsel, do the guidelines even apply to temporary support?
Presumptively, they do.
Amounts in excess of $4,000 are not controlled by the guidelines. Is my recollection?
That is correct. However, the guidelines presumptively apply only to temporary child support. And in this order, we're not limited to temporary child support. In this order, we're talking about temporary alimony and temporary child support, temporary spousal support and temporary child support combined.
How are we to resolve on this record the disagreement between the lawyers over whether this was an agreed order or not?
I'm sorry? How do you resolve it on the record?
We to resolve that dispute between the lawyers as to whether this was an agreed order or not?
You look at the order, and there is nothing that Judge O'Donnell had before him had anything to do with an arrearage in January 1, 1991, or an arrearage in February 1, 1991. It was never brought before him. It was never passed upon him, and yet it's in the order, and it's over the signatures of both lawyers, of the lawyers for both parties.
You don't think there's an ambiguity in the order?
No, sir.
Well, it's rely upon extrinsic factors to establish the fact that it was an agreed order, do you not?
You do not have to know if it's an agreed order in order to determine whether it's ambiguous. That line of inquiry I don't follow.
No, I don't mean that the order was ambiguous. I mean whether it was agreed or not.
Well, the part that we're talking about in the application for writ of habeas corpus is directed to whether the order was ambiguous, and the order was not ambiguous. Craig Hall simply refused to obey it.
Well, as I understand Relator's argument, they said they didn't have, there wasn't an opportunity to cross-examine Ms. Hall, and that's part of the reason they think the order is unenforceable under these circumstances by contempt. You say that your argument relies upon the agreed
nature of the order.
Under McCray.
Not upon due process being given to Mr. Hall in the underlying temporary order hearing. So what I'm asking is, how can we look at the order, two signatures of lawyers, not saying agreed as to form only, not agreed, it doesn't say agreed as to form and substance, how can we look at the order without regarding extrinsic factors and determining whether in fact that's correct or not?
Well, I think that the extrinsic factors that you would have to look at would be the product of the offer of proof.
So we do have to look at extrinsic factors. We can't just look at the order and figure that out.
No, sir.
Okay.
I'm not conceding. No, sir, did not mean that I agreed with you. I'm sorry. I miscommunicated. My point is that when looking at the order, that order on its face, within the four corners of the order, is a valid court order. If the relator wants to attack the court order, because the relator feels compelled or he feels an obligation to provide extrinsic evidence that the order was produced, was the product of fraud, was the product of lack of authority, etc., then that's his defensive burden under the pleading requirements of the Texas Family Code. That's an affirmative defense. He's got to plead it. He's got to prove it. He didn't either.
And what they have pled attempted to show is that there was no opportunity for due process in the form of cross-examination
during
the underlying hearing. Why doesn't that meet their burden?
Well, I think you can look, sir, from the face of this record, and you can determine whether there was opportunity or not. I would draw the court's attention.
Well, it doesn't make any difference if there was an opportunity if this is an agreed order.
That's true.
How do we know, and that's your contention, how do we know it's an agreed order by looking at the face of it?
Because it contains things on its face that the trial court never passed upon. It contains things on its face. For example, how much on December 28th did the trial...
two things. That could mean it's an agreed order. That could mean the trial court entered an order without hearing evidence.
I think, Your Honor, that if the trial court had ordered it, that is, I find that the arrearage for December 1 is $5,000 and the arrearage for January 1 is $6,000 and the arrearage for February 1 is $8,000, I think that would appear somewhere in the record, and it does not. There is no record of that. In the relator's argument in the trial court, the relator made much ado, and it is before you, over the fact that the record that now is before you is a complete record of everything that transpired in the trial court. So there's no vacuum in your record. It's there. If it's there, and it's not there. The trial judge never agreed, never ordered to it, never adjudicated it. Would have been impossible for the trial court to adjudicate what happened on January 1, 1991, on December 28, 1990. And yet he did it for January 1, 1991, and he did it for February 1, 1991. If it had been merely an approval as to form, then I think Hugh Hackney would have said, well, on these days the hearing was held. It wouldn't have agreed that all prerequisites of law had been complied with. If I may return to the appellate court argument, I think that the Missouri K&T Railway case versus Cade cited in our brief adequately deals with...
Your time has expired. Are there any questions? Thank you.
There are so many things that I would like to respond to and so many things that are left in this case, but one of the things I have attempted to do is simplify the issues. One thing that I would like to just quickly point out to you, and we've cited this to the court, is in the contempt hearing, volume 1, page 18, the court goes on into detail as this is not an agreed order. This is an order that was submitted to me pursuant to my request. It is based on a contract. Also, at the February hearing where the court made this ruling, The very last thing he says, page 27, after he goes into his analysis of the contract, is bring me an order. The fact that those attorney signatures are there doesn't make it an agreed order, and I hope that we don't have to spend a good part of my 5 minutes addressing that. I will if the court's concerned about it. But that's not an agreed order. Counsel is reaching, and the reason he's reaching...
Why else would you sign it?
Why else would you sign it?
I mean, wouldn't a lawyer be ill-advised to be putting a name on an order like this?
Well, sure, and in the...
To indicate that it was either agreed or that he had approved it.
He
and
could...
If it had happened without a hearing, would he be wise to approve it?
He would not be wise, and if you'll look at that order, there is no corresponding order for Marianna Hall to pay one penny of anything with the money that she gets. Mr. Hackney was ill-advised in a lot of ways, and you'll notice he's no longer in the case. Mr. Hall has lost attorneys due to conflict, but I think you can read in the record that Mr. Hackney withdrew and pointed out in the May hearing that the reason he was withdrawing was not because he had a problem with Mr. Hall, but because Mr. Hall had a problem with Mr. Hackney. That temporary order orders Craig Hall to pay $23,982.75. It does not require Marianna Hall to pay a utility bill, to pay the mortgage company, and in fact, at the contempt hearing, she testified she was not making those payments. And so what was Mr. Hall doing to keep the house from being foreclosed, to keep the utilities from being cut off? He was paying every creditor that had been used on that exhibit on which the expenses were based. She testified she didn't make the payment. She didn't know who made the payment. She didn't know where her checkbook was. She didn't know anything. But her utilities hadn't been cut off, and the house hadn't been paid.
Mr. Hackney may have been ill and biased, but if he was authorized and he signed it, what other purpose could he have had in mind?
Well, orders are signed all the time as reflecting what the court ruled, not necessarily that it was an agreement of the parties. There's no indication down there that's agreed or approved as a form as anything, and I don't think the presumption could be that it was an agreed order, especially in light of the court statement where he goes over that. And at the time that the court made those statements, Mr. Hall was pro se because his attorneys had been conflicted out because of another lawsuit. Mr. Hackney was not at that hearing, I agree. Subsequently, he said he didn't have the authority to even sign that. He never represented that it was an agreed order. If you read the record, Justice Heck, from the February hearing and the May hearing, which was the beginning of the contempt hearing, it is obvious that this is not an agreed order. It's an easy argument to make with a cold record, with some attorney's signatures right in front of you, but it is very obvious from the judge's statement and from the attorney's statements that this was not an agreement. There is talk about an agreement because at the May hearing, they thought they had settled the entire case. And one of the issues that I didn't really want to get bogged down into is one of the reasons Mr. Hall is paying directly to the creditors, and it's an exhibit and it's also in the May hearing, is Mrs. Hall's then counsel was agreeing that Mr. Hall could pay these creditors directly. Now, I understand that attorney's agreements will not excuse his failure to comply with a court order, and therefore that's not one of the issues before the court. But the agreements that were being attempted to be inked out had to do with the entire lawsuit, not the agreement as the temporary order. The agreement between counsel was that Craig Hall could pay the mortgage company and these utility companies directly. And there is evidence of that in the record, but not that he agreed to the temporary order. The judge says time and again, and it's quoted in our reply brief on page 6, this was not an agreed order. This was my order. I told the attorneys to submit the order to us.
Counsel, your time has expired. Are there any questions? Thank you. That concludes the arguments for this morning and concludes the court's official business in open session. The marshal, the foregoing comments are submitted on briefs and oral arguments, and the marshal will now please adjourn the court.
The audience, please rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned. The subject